death. I studied her face. She was much younger, far too young to be doing what she was doing. Not as gorgeous and distinct then as she would turn out to be, but obviously filled with courage. She was wearing her glasses, but I could still see her brown eyes, and her teeth were a hard white line in her face. My heart knotted at the sight of her in danger, though obviously that incident must have turned out just fine. She was beautiful. I'm such a sap. I snapped out of my reverie and tried to pay attention to Harbinger's lesson. I had missed part of what he had said, but I did not dare ask him to repeat it. He was finishing up on the dangers of facing whites. Their touch causes immediate paralysis, even through armor. It wears off quickly, but by then it's usually too late. They can be insanely strong, so don't screw around against these without backup and heavy weapons. What happened? I blurted. Huh? He answered. In the picture with this white. Harbinger paused, probably debating whether he should rip me for butting in or just tell the story. He was notorious amongst the newbies for not telling the stories behind their adventures, as opposed to Sam, or especially Milo, who seemed to love it. Finally, the internal battle was ended, and he decided to share. However, the look he fixed me with let me know that I would be running laps until I puked because of the interruption. Outside of Sandusky, Ohio, October of 95, just before Halloween. Crazy time of year in this business. My team was taking care of a ghoul problem at an old cemetery when this one surprised us. We didn't expect a white. It popped out of the ground right in front of our vehicle, crushed the whole front end with its bare hands, and smashed through the window like it was nothing. I was in the passenger seat, and it was on me so fast that it was a blur. It hit me, and all of my muscles locked right up like I was frozen. Milo was driving. It nailed him, too. Julie was in the back seat. She opened up right between us with her pistol, surprised it, apparently, because it quit trying to kill me and Milo. The white jumped on the roof and started peeling it back to get her. She bailed out with that spear. He paused and chewed on his lower lip for a moment. Make a note. It was a good thing she didn't just keep using her gun. Firearms will stop a white eventually, but eventually is the key word. See, the longer an undead like the white exists, the stronger it becomes. New ones are pretty easy to kill, but this particular son of a bitch dated back to the Civil War. They can take forever to quit, so you work in teams, hold them off while you pour fire into them. The rest of the team heard the commotion on the radio, and they were coming fast, but not fast enough. So anyways, Julie gets out and uses the spear to hold it back. Every time it moved, she would stick it. You can see in the slide that it has a catch past the blade to keep creatures from slipping down the shaft to get you. She kept sticking it, and basically played keep away. It couldn't reach her as long as she kept stabbing it, but there was no way that spear was going to put it down. The guy that took the picture was no help. He was just some bozo bystander. Great shot, though. Finally, the feeling returned to my limbs enough to flop out of the Suburban, and I lit him up. Lit him up? Somebody else asked. Flamethrower. Don't fight high-level undead without one. Once its flesh was on fire, it was only a matter of time before it ran out of steam. Julie pinned it to a mausoleum door and held it there until it quit kicking. Took forever. Mean sons of bitches.
How old was she?
Holly asked.
Harbinger thought about it for a moment.
She had just turned 18.
Damn.
It runs in the family. He returned to the lesson. Sawing off a human head is harder than it looks. The body tends to flop around every time you hit it, and it makes a really nasty mess. Once goo gets on the handle of your knife, it gets even worse, and the next thing you know, your blade is glancing off of bones that you didn't even know were there. I grunted as I strained the blade against the rubbery flesh.
"Damn it, Pitt, don't saw! This ain't gardening, it's killing! Chop it!"
Sam shouted at me. Sam always shouted. Responding to the order, I raised the heavy knife over my head and brought it down with as much force as possible, this time chopping completely through the tissue and breaking the vertebrae. The cadaver's head rolled off the table and landed on the floor with a damp thud.
"Much better,"
the instructor bellowed.
"See that, class? Don't screw around with them. There are some things that don't quit until you take their heads off. If you have got to do it quick. Solid whack like you're chopping wood. Don't pussyfoot around. And remember, the fresh ones squirt more."
Our class of remaining newbies was slowly shaping up into a coherent team of hunters. Currently, we were standing in a small refrigerated room near the hangar, known as the Body Shack. MHI had saved the most disgusting lessons for the last of us. I'm sure that staking and beheading corpses was practical training, but I believe that the main reason we did this was to weed out the trainees who couldn't handle the sheer nastiness of lopping off a human head. It probably would have been more efficient to do the horrific stuff first, as it really took out anyone with a weak stomach. According to Milo, the reason we saved it for this late in the training was that it was hard to get a good supply of medical school leftover bodies. By saving this part until most of the trainees had washed out, he had to scrounge up fewer corpses. Milo was a pretty efficient guy.
"Next team, Newcastle and Meade,"
Sam said to Holly and Chuck, the next people in line, as Milo used a hose to spray down the floor. Several of the other newbies had lost their lunch on this exercise. Mingled fluids coagulated around the central drain. Placing the gore-spattered knife on the table, I stumbled away to wash my hands. They were shaking badly, and I felt a strong urge to vomit. Tripp was already at the sink, scrubbing furiously.
"Dude, that sucked," he hissed.
"Next time I stake, you chop," I replied. "Hey, you called heads. Not my fault. At least it wasn't the gut crawl." He frowned at me.
"Come on, man, I'm already trying not to barf as it is. Don't bring that up."
The gut crawl had consisted of a single newbie wriggling through a long section of pipe filled with cow entrails. Between the dark, the smell, the heat of the pipe, and the horrible squishiness of it all, it was probably the worst experience of my life, up to and including actually dying. Supposedly it had been a test of our ability to deal with disturbing surroundings and still keep our wits. Personally, I thought it was Harbinger torturing us. Two of our class had quit rather than do it, and when I had been stuck halfway down that dark pipe, covered in slime and feces and intestines, I had envied them. One other trainee had made it halfway down the pipe, only to suffer a panic attack and lock up. All three of them had been given fat severance checks and sent home. There were only a dozen of us left. Judging by the standards of our instructors, it was no surprise that MHI was currently short-handed. Harbinger had been very upfront about it, though. He was a firm believer that the harder we sweated in practice, the less we would bleed when it was for real. Holly finished her staking and came over to wash up. She seemed unperturbed by the minor fact that she had just used a hammer to drive a sharpened wooden shaft through what had once been a real live person's rib cage. I had been surprised by our former stripper. Nothing ever seemed to faze her, and she attacked every job with a vengeance. We still had not learned her story, but it was obvious that she well and truly hated the other team, and she was looking forward to exacting some payback. If that required crawling through guts or chopping off limbs, no problem.
"That wasn't so bad. Chuck got stuck with the head. Poor guy.
He brought it on himself, though,
she said, flashing us with a wicked grin.
How?
Asked Tripp, still washing his hands.
I had news for him. No amount of water was going to make us feel clean after what we had just done.
He always goes rock, never paper or scissors. Dumbass.
She examined the old blood staining her nails.
By the way, I overheard Dorcas talking to Milo. Harbinger's pretty happy with how we're doing. We're going to get the whole weekend off.
Awesome, I exclaimed.
We had been training hard for a solid month. I'd be more than ready for a break this weekend. With the prospect of an actual couple of days off, I suddenly didn't mind so much being covered in gore. It'll be good to get out of here.
No kidding, she replied,
then turned toward Tripp, who was adding more soap and giving it another try.
Dude, Tripp, you need to hurry up. The rest of us need a turn, too.
Ugh, you have no idea what kind of bacteria is in something like this, he said.
You've got to do a good job sanitizing. Weren't you a science teacher?
Holly asked.
Chemistry. And I subbed band and I was the assistant football coach. It was a small school.
Being his roommate, I knew his story well. Having to cave in some students' heads once they had joined the ranks of the undead really tended to mess up a teaching career.
I figured with all of the frog dissecting you wouldn't be so damn squeamish. Hey, you have some blood or snot or something in your dreads.
As he reached up in disgust, Holly cut in front of him to wash her hands.
Sucker.
With a thwacking noise and a flourish, Chuck took his cadaver's head off, and Sam bellowed at us the fact that we did not do too bad for a bunch of derelicts, thus ending another day of training. My breath came in ragged gasps. I had long since passed the point where I could control it. The muscles in my legs were on fire, especially where Huffman's talons had pierced me, and my feet and knees ached with each footfall. Blinking away the sweat in my eyes, I pushed on, trying to once again find that point of oblivion where the pain didn't matter. I hate running. All big men hate running. Sure, I could sprint, but you don't see very many 300-pound marathoners for good reason. Only crazy people run for fun. The last mile of Forest Trail was the worst. It had the steepest hills and the most rutted path of the whole trek. But I took comfort as I made my way up the red dirt road, as we were almost done for the day. It had started just after dawn, with hours of physical training, tactics, armed and unarmed combat practice, monster class, and now the sun was down and we were limping in from a 6-mile run from hell. Finally, the trees thinned, and I even managed to smile as we passed the kudzu-covered chain-link fence to enter the compound. Most of the newbies had already arrived and were crashing out on the available benches or stretching on the grass. The good runners like Tripp, Lee, and Meade looked almost relaxed and refreshed from the little jaunt. Tripp's good-natured thumbs up made me want to beat him to death.
"About time, Pitt,"
Grant Jefferson shouted. He glanced at his stopwatch in disgust.
Pathetic. Just pathetic.
He had led the run and had made most of the rest of us look bad. Of course, some of us came out looking worse than others. One of the other newbies stumbled off to the side to puke. Grant just smirked.
"All right, we're done for now. Stretch out tonight because we're doing this twice tomorrow."
Everyone groaned. I sat on one of the empty benches and put my head in my hands. I knew that I was supposed to walk around and gradually let my heart rate subside to avoid muscle soreness, but man, I just needed a break. I excelled at everything physical, except for this. Gradually my panting turned to normal breathing, and my heart was no longer pounding away. The other newbies began to wander off toward the barracks for some much-needed sleep. I stayed on the bench to enjoy the cool twilight.
Hi.
A lovely voice spoke from behind me.
Mind if I have a seat?
It was Julie.
No. Yes, I mean, of course, I stammered, sliding over so she could fit.
She dropped down next to me with a smile. She was wearing shorts and looked like she had been working out. I tried not to stare at her well-muscled legs. I was suddenly very self-conscious about my sweat-soaked T-shirt. I bet I stunk.
So how's everything going?
She asked. Fine, I'm doing okay. Except for that. I jerked my thumb toward the cross-country track. That sucks. She laughed, hopefully with me, not at me.
I know it. I hate it, too. Not all of us are like Grant.
She pointed across the field. A lone figure stood 100 yards away, throwing punches at invisible foes under the lights of the obstacle course. Grant Jefferson had stuck around after the newbies had left. He had stripped off his shirt and was practicing what appeared to be some extremely difficult martial exercises. I hated to admit it, but the man was a near-perfect physical specimen. If monster hunting didn't work out for him, I was sure he could get a gig as an underwear model. So, how long have you guys been dating? I asked, trying not to sound jealous. I don't know if I succeeded.
Couple months,
she answered as she looked at me suspiciously.
Why?
Oh, I don't know. He just seems a little...
arrogant?
I paused, not quite sure how to answer that. Yeah, I guess. He just doesn't strike me as your type, is all.
And you know my type how?
She asked, studying me carefully. I swallowed, wanting to shout, me! Thankfully, she continued before I had to answer.
Yes, I know Grant comes off a little arrogant, but he really is a great guy. He's smart and ambitious. He was in Harvard Law School when we recruited him.
Figures, I thought to myself. The CPA exam is way harder than passing the bar, I muttered.
What?
Nothing.
We hit it off when he arrived here. Grant's traveled the world. He's sophisticated, cultured, educated. He's done a lot of really interesting things. So he's kind of confident. That comes off as cocky sometimes.
Comes off as an ass. I bit my tongue. I knew the truth. I bet he drowned sacks of puppies for fun. In the distance, Grant had dropped down and started doing push-ups. Well, good for you guys. I've got to get some sleep. I stood up to leave.
Good night, Owen.
Yeah, night, Julie. I wandered off. It figured that I had finally met the perfect woman, only to find out she wasn't interested in me. I kicked over the garbage can outside the barracks. Screw it. I was tired.
What are you doing?
Tripp asked me as he entered our tiny barracks room. The windows were open and loud insects chirped and whistled in the darkness outside. I don't know, I answered honestly. I was sitting on my bunk, suitcase open on the floor in front of me. My right hand ached from the impact it had taken an hour earlier. Thinking about packing, I guess.
You didn't strike me as a quitter, he said simply. That was an accident with Green. You didn't mean to hurt him. Milo says he'll be out of the hospital in a week. It's just his collarbone and a concussion.
I only hit him once. We had been practicing going hands-on. Never a good choice against a monster, but a necessary skill to have, nonetheless. They had paired me up with Green, a muscle-bound former narc. It had gotten kind of competitive.
Stuff happens, Tripp shrugged. Don't be a baby about it.
Sam said I wasn't being aggressive enough.
He probably shouldn't have said that to somebody who beat up a werewolf.
Tripp sat on his bed.
When Green wakes up, he'll be cool. It was an accident.
I shook my head.
No, it wasn't. I got angry. I didn't hold back. Look, man, this is why I should probably go. When I get mad, when I lose control, people get hurt.
You make it sound like you're the Hulk, he laughed. You're training to be a monster hunter. We're supposed to hurt things. Come on, dude, what's the deal?
Trip had become a good friend over the last few weeks of training, and I could tell that he did honestly want to help. I stared down at the open suitcase. You know I used to fight for money, right? I continued, not looking up. A few years ago, I had a big one. My last one. Lots of cash on the table. The other guy was supposed to be a real badass. Supposedly he had killed a couple of people in prison. There were no rules, and it wasn't supposed to stop until one of us couldn't fight anymore. Last man standing got paid.
Why would you do that?
He asked, sincerely perplexed. Tripp was a good man, and the idea of inflicting violence on another human being for no good reason was truly foreign to him. I sighed. You've got to understand. My whole life, my father tried to prepare me for something. All he did was push. He had some sort of fucked-up vision of the future, and he wanted me to be ready for it. I guess I just needed to prove that I was as tough as he thought I was.
So what happened?
The other fighter really was a bad dude. Meanest I had ever dealt with. I couldn't take him. He just wouldn't quit. Then something happened. Something snapped, broke loose. No pain, just focus. Like when Huffman tried to eat me. Next thing I knew, I had blood up to my armpits and I was kneeling on this guy while I hit him until my knuckles broke. Tripp looked shocked.
You killed him?
Almost. And I would have. But the promoters pulled me off. They managed to stitch his skull back together, but he lost an eye. I've heard he's still all messed up. I would have killed him. And right then I wanted to kill him. And for what? How stupid is that?
Pretty stupid.
We sat in silence for a while, Tripp not really knowing what to say. I knew from our talks that he was a devoutly religious man and was probably trying to think of how to politely tell me that I was surely going to hell. Finally, I spoke. You know why I became an accountant?
Pays better than teaching.
I picked the most straight-laced, stereotypically boring thing that I could think of. My entire life I'd been taught to be a killer. But after that night, I just wanted to get as far away from it as I could.
But you still carried a gun every day?
I didn't go looking for trouble. Didn't mean I wasn't ready for trouble to look for me, I answered. Beats hitting zombies with a pickaxe, he muttered. And now here I am, in this place, where all the things I've spent the last few years trying to distance myself from are not only encouraged, they're mandatory. And it seems like I might actually be pretty good at this. But I'm worried.
That you'll hurt somebody who don't need hurting?
Yeah, something like that. I clenched my scarred-up fists. My hand throbbed from where I had slugged Green. It had only been a brief instant, a flash of anger, but that was all it took. Tripp thought about it for a few long seconds, absently chewing on his lower lip, then stood.
The way I see it, we're here to do good. I don't know about you, but I came here to stop monsters from hurting folks. The Lord's given you a gift, a weird one, but still a gift, and the fact that you're worried about misusing it means that you're not a bad guy. So put that suitcase away, man up, and let's get to class before Harbinger realizes we're late. He kind of scares me.
He thumped me on the shoulder and walked out the door. I waited a moment, listening to the angry buzz of the insects crashing against the window screen. Then I pushed the suitcase back under my bunk and went back to work. I thought I understood discomfort and heat. I had lived in Texas for a few years, and I had grown up in the San Joaquin Valley of California. One was miserably hot and windy, the other was muggy from all the open-air irrigation. But summer in the heart of Dixie was a whole new type of evil. So hot that you couldn't think, and so wet you could almost drink the air. Summer had come to Alabama. So, of course, this was the day when we were issued our body armor. It was heavy, and though well-designed to be comfortable and breathable, during summers in Alabama, a pair of shorts and a tank top were considered warm clothing. I was sweating profusely. Not that that said much, considering that men of my bulk usually started sweating at room temperature, but this was particularly bad. Thankfully, the armor came equipped with a Camelback water bladder and drinking tube. As their ad so eloquently stated, hydrate or die. Milo Anderson paced back and forth in front of the assembled newbies. Today he was wearing a Violent Femmes t-shirt, and his red beard had been braided into two separate forks, both seemingly long enough to rappel from. Occasionally he would stop before a newbie, examine them critically, and then pause long enough to adjust some strap or buckle. He was the creator of the suit, as well as many of the other devices the hunting teams used. Grant Jefferson watched us smugly in our discomfort. He was wearing his armor, which had been tailored to suit him better. Holly had said that he was dashingly handsome, and even she, being so very jaded and cynical about men because of her background, found him very charismatic and charming. She told me that it was easy to see why Grant and Julie had hooked up. He was young, smart, good-looking, knew how to talk to people, and everybody loved him. I still wanted to kick his ass. On Grant's shoulder was a patch with the green smiley face with horns that was the unofficial company logo, which only Harbinger's personal team wore. We had been told that the other teams made up their own logos. The only other team logo that I had seen here at the compound had been a fire-breathing warthog that Dorcas had engraved onto her plastic leg. Grant wore the smiley face with pride. Apparently it was a real honor to end up on Harbinger's team. I had learned that he had only been a hunter since the business had reopened, but he had shown so much potential in training that he had been picked to fill a void on what was considered the best team. "You will learn to live in these suits for days at a time. This suit will save your life. This suit will become like a second skin to you." Grant was lecturing us, gesturing at his own gear. Milo stopped in front of me with a scowl and adjusted the webbing around my torso. Apparently, Milo had never had to make a suit for somebody as big as I am, and it had been a bit of a challenge to come up with Kevlar sheets for a 62-inch chest.
"Psst, Milo," I whispered. "Since these are supposed to be like second skins, where's yours?"
"Screw that. It's hot," he answered.
"And he invented the darn thing." "Testify, brother," I thought.
"One time this suit saved my life. You can see right here where I was clawed by a golem. See, right there on the abdomen? Surely this would have been a mortal blow, but I was able to shrug it off and stay in the fight. I dispatched the monster and was able to rush to the aid of my team and save them from certain death," Grant told us, lifting up the front of his armor so we could all see his sculpted abs. The man must do crunches in his sleep to look like that. Grant had been talking forever, and unlike the other instructors, did not have a drop of humility in his soul. I was about 10 minutes from a heat stroke, and we were stuck suffering in the sun while our teacher blathered. Milo rolled his eyes and went back to adjusting straps. "Some golem. It was 3 feet tall," he muttered under his breath so it was barely audible to just me. "Ass." The armor was a modular system that could be configured by the user depending on what kind of threat we were going to face. A thick layer of stab-proof Kevlar covered the vital organs. Though not much heavier than regular thick clothing,
The sleeves and pant legs had the same fibers sewn into the fabric. There was a neck guard that could be raised to resemble a turtleneck to protect against bites. Most of the threats we would face would involve teeth or claws, so unlike regular body armor, ours was designed for that rather than for bullet resistance. Milo informed us that the torso was rated the same as a traditional level 3A bulletproof vest, able to stop most pistol rounds. There were pouches on the front and back designed to hold ceramic plates that could stop rifle rounds if the threat warranted it, and if the user didn't mind the extra weight. The system incorporated load-bearing gear and pouches for magazines, weapons, tools, medical kits, and whatever other useful things the hunter might need. There were two different types of gloves that came with the suit. One was a basic shooting glove that offered a small amount of protection, but still allowed good dexterity. And the other was a heavy armored gauntlet for when you needed maximum protection and just had to wade in and crush some heads. The heavy units could be attached to the end of the sleeves. There were also two types of helmets. The first was simply a modified hockey helmet, good basically to keep you from banging yourself on the skull when blundering around in the dark. The second, an armored monstrosity that looked kind of like a motorcycle helmet with a full visor and face shield, could be attached to the neck guard. With the heavy gloves and big helmet, a suited monster hunter could become a chew toy for a pile of zombies and come out gnawed on, but unbitten. Unfortunately for me, Milo did not have a helmet that would fit my enormous head, so he had special ordered one. Hopefully nothing would try to eat me before then. The armor had lots of extras designed just for the people in our peculiar business. A CO2 cartridge was carried in the shoulder harness. In case of emergency, it could be activated, and the harness would inflate. Handy if you got dumped into deep water, because it was difficult to swim while strapped with piles of gear. My understanding was that Sam, our former SEAL, had insisted on that device. Each suit also had a GPS unit for navigation, which occasionally came in handy to locate a hunter's body when the bad guys won. The armor could be ordered in whatever color you wanted, as long as it was black, olive drab, or coyote brown. There was not a lot of use for festive colors in monster hunting, nor were there a lot of suppliers of heavyweight military strength Cordura in any other colors. I had gone with brown. Grant had gone with black. He probably thought it made him look tough. I thought he looked kind of like a silly version of Darth Vader. I took comfort in the fact that he had to be cooking in the sun right about now, though the bastard did not even give me the satisfaction of looking uncomfortable. "Pay attention," Grant snapped at me. Milo rolled his eyes again. I snickered. Grant stormed toward us like a bulldog. "Pitt, I don't like your attitude."
"Trust me, Grant, it's mutual," I snapped back.
"What did you say?" He poked me in the chest with his trigger finger. I couldn't feel a thing through the armor, but that did not change the fact that I did not like getting poked. It was hot, I was tired, and frankly in no mood to put up with any nonsense. Milo wisely moved aside.
"I said it's mutual, meaning I don't like your attitude either."
"I'm trying to teach you newbies how to stay alive."
"Then teach. All I'm hearing is stories about how great you are. I came here to learn how to kill stuff, not to join your fan club."
He stabbed me again. "I'm a pro. You need to shut your stupid newbie mouth. You think you know so much. I saw that video. You got lucky with that werewolf, and now you think you're hot shit."
"You had best take that hand off of me," I said.
The rest of the class was gradually spreading out around us. The group could sense trouble brewing and were ready for some entertainment. Apparently, I was not the only one in a foul mood.
"Or what?"
And he poked harder. It was really kind of a useless gesture, considering the armor could stop a battle axe.
With years of experience bouncing rowdy people from bars, I had a good sense of when somebody was itching for trouble. And Grant was itching bad. "I'll take it off and feed it to you." I smiled at him and winked. That really seemed to anger him. Grant's movie star face turned bright red. He was as tall as I was, but not nearly as big or as strong. I had no doubt that I could beat him mercilessly.
"I could have you kicked out of here like that."
He took his hand away long enough to snap his fingers. Then he went back to poking me.
"For what?"
asked Milo, arms folded, studying the other instructor. Milo was by far the senior in experience and in the amount of respect he received from the trainees. That was easy enough. Milo Anderson was a likable guy. Grant, on the other hand...
"Insubordination," Grant hissed. "One word to the boss about your attitude and you're gone."
"If I'm going to get kicked out, believe me, I'm going to have some fun doing it." I felt my body tense as the adrenaline began to flow. If Grant wanted a piece of me, I was prepared to give that preppy piece of trash what he wanted.
"Grant," Milo spoke quietly, "that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. You're picking a fight with somebody who outweighs you by 100 pounds of muscle. Insubordination, my butt. You say anything to the boss, and my side of the story will be that you were trying to commit suicide by accountant."
"I could take him," the junior instructor stated coldly.
"He isn't as tough as everybody thinks."
"Grant, I could kick your ass. Pitt would make you his bitch." That took the wind out of Grant's sails. I could see the realization dawn in his blue eyes, the realization that I could probably turn him into pulp. I just kept smiling, still prepared to mess up his pretty face and give him the opportunity to digest some of his perfectly white teeth. He had already pushed too far, though. He could not back off now without looking bad. He leaned in close and whispered in my ear,
"Stay away from Julie, you son of a bitch. I've seen you looking at her."
I was surprised. So that was what this was all about. I had barely even seen her since training had started.
"Bite me," I replied.
"Enough!"
Milo shouted. "Class is over. It's too hot and everybody's tempers are short. You've been working hard. Go grab some lunch."
Grant stepped back and glared at the little man. Milo met his gaze evenly. I think that my nemesis quickly realized that the other instructor had just given him a window of opportunity to back out of his potential beating and not look like a wimp in front of the others. Grant Jefferson may have been a prick, but he was no dummy.
"Fine. Class dismissed," Grant sneered. "I'll be seeing you around, Pitt."
He spun on his polished boots and haughtily strode away. "Looking forward to it," I rumbled under my breath as the group began to disperse. Milo shouted for all of us to turn our suits into his workshop for adjustments before we left the compound for our weekend off. There were some relieved sighs as the newbies unceremoniously began to remove their armor. I stomped away to avoid speaking to anybody. Not that it did me much good. One person followed me. Trip patted me on my armored shoulder to get my attention.
"Have I ever told you how much I respect your professionalism and restraint?"
"Some people just need a good beating."
"I agree. The man's a jerk. But last night I talked you out of quitting, so I don't want to see you get fired today,"
Trip said as we started toward the cafeteria, new suits creaking. Hopefully they would break in and soften up. My friend continued speaking as if I was one of his former ignorant teenage students.
"You know why he hates you, right?"
I had spoken about my infatuation with Julie Shackelford to Tripp. He was my roommate, after all. "I suppose I do."
"Well, then you would be wrong."
"Huh?
You think it's because of the girl. Grant probably thinks it's because of the girl, too. That's because you're both idiots.
Gee, thanks, Trip.
We continued walking slowly, talking quietly so the others wouldn't hear our conversation.
Well, if it isn't because of her, what's his problem?
You're his problem. I've seen this before. Grant is the golden boy. He came in here last year and tore stuff up. He's the best at everything. Even the big dogs took him under their wing. I bet he has won at everything he's ever tried. You come along, and you're naturally better than him at some things, so immediately he doesn't like you. It is all about pride, my friend, and Grant is stuffed so full of it, it's a wonder he doesn't burst.
Okay, I can see that.
And you do keep staring at his woman like a slobbering moron.
Slobbering? That hurt.
And you're a smartass who can't help but show him up every chance that you get.
Fair enough.
And you can't handle losing just as bad as him. You're both torn up with pride, and like the Bible says, pride is the sin that will drag you down faster than anything else.
Where does it say that?
Luke, chapter something or other. Well, that's what my mom said about it anyway.
Thanks, Pastor Jones. I'll be sure to keep my pride and my slobbering in check from now on. I laughed. He was not that much older than I was, but somewhere along the line, Tripp had gained a lot more wisdom than I had.
That's Father Reverend Elder Jones to you, heathen. Now let's get some lunch. We got the whole weekend off, and we're going to need our energy. I've got an auntie who lives in Wetumpka, up past Montgomery, and we're going to have us a party. Have you ever had chitlins? Bona fide southern delicacy.
Can't say that I have.
What the hell's a chitlin? The way he said it, I didn't know if chitlins were a delicacy or a form of torture.
Probably could go either way, depending on your perspective.
Then you're going to have yourself one hell of a weekend, Z.
Chapter 6. I was dreaming. I found myself in the same field as I'd been in during the strange dream that I had experienced in the hospital. Once again, the crop was lush and green, and my feet were bare. The air was cool and fresh, so I definitely was not in Alabama. The sky was darker, and thick black rain clouds were collecting on the horizon. It looked like it was going to be a terrible storm. The old man was there also. This time he was sitting on a small, grassy mound. His hair was still wild and white. His cane sat on the ground next to him, and he was absently polishing his small, round glasses on a white handkerchief.
"Hello, boy. Welcome again here."
His accent was still thick, reminding me somewhat of my grandparents on my mom's side of the family. A deep, Eastern European sound, but not from any of the languages that I spoke. "What am I doing here?" I asked, sitting down on the grass next to him. We watched the storm front approach. The wind was beginning to pick up, and the crop was waving under the onslaught. "I thought you said that we wouldn't meet again unless I did something stupid and got killed."
"I was wrong. I knew it this too," he answered. "He's closer now, so I help more easy."
"What is closer now?"
"You will see. It comes."
He pointed at the storm roiling across the distant landscape.
"What comes?" "The storm. I show you when can. I help you if can."
"Help me with what?" This was a confusing dream, not helped at all by my host's mangled English.
"The evil comes. The cursed one brings. You will stop if can. If not, time will die."
He stated it as if that cryptic information was a simple fact.
"Who are you?" "I told you. I am friend. I here to help."
He spit on his glasses and continued to polish them. I noticed that he wore a small Star of David around his neck.
His clothes were old and simple, and appeared to be sewn by hand. "What's your name?"
"No one asked that for a long time."
"That doesn't answer the question," I replied.
"My name not matter now, boy. I am just old man."
He held up the glasses and examined them, nodding in satisfaction before placing them on his face.
"He's good. Help me up, please."
I stood, and then lent him a hand as he slowly rose to his feet. I retrieved his cane and handed it over. The polished wood was surprisingly heavy and dense. As I looked up, I realized that somehow the storm had drawn impossibly close. The blue sky was blotted out, and the wall that was approaching was a swirling mass of darkness, clouds, and lightning. The sky had taken on a green halo, and I could feel the energy crackling through the ground. The crop was lying down or being torn out of the soil as powerful gusts struck us.
"We go now. I show you what I can. I need your help."
"Okay," I answered, not knowing what else to say.
"You help me, I help you. No can promise it will work, but I will try."
He grasped my wrist. His cold hands were frail and arthritic. He adjusted his glasses and watched with hard eyes as the storm approached. It was moving across the land like a tidal wave now, closing on us with what seemed like malevolent intent. As it grew closer, I could see that there were shapes in the clouds. Warriors, monsters, death, plague, famine, suffering, pestilence, and war. My pleasant dream was changing into a nightmare. The roar of wind and crashing of thunder and wails of something else washed over us. The wall of black hit us, and we were swiftly engulfed. Still dreaming. Only now I was somehow above the MHI compound. I had no body, but somehow I could see. And not only that, I could see everything. Walls meant nothing to me. Maybe seeing wasn't the right term. I was aware of everything. I was not limited by the information that my eyes could register or that my brain could process. I found my body sleeping peacefully in the barracks. Trip, in the bunk above, was reading some pulp fantasy novel as he did every night. The man was a fantasy book addict. The rest of my fellow trainees were sleeping, or pretending to. In the women's barracks, I was not surprised to learn that Holly Newcastle slept in the nude. As interesting as that sight was, I moved on. I was no peeping Tom, or in this case, a peeping ghost. The office/fortress was totally open to me now. It was much larger than any of us had realized, with a huge underground level that was a complete secret to the trainees. In the dark corners, I glimpsed that not all the other employees were human. What a strange dream. On the top floor, our instructors were holding a meeting around a huge table. Julie, Harbinger, Sam, Milo, and Grant were arguing about something. I focused in on that, and somehow my presence joined them in the room. Movements were cloudy, and the voices were indistinct and muffled because of all the other sensations I was receiving without my normal faculties.
"No other teams are available. Just us and the newbies. Boone's team's in Atlanta. They just finished a case and they can meet us on the way. I can send them the schematics."
Julie was speaking.
"We'll need extra men,"
Sam said, his voice echoing strangely.
"Freighter that big is too hard to cover with just two teams, and we don't have enough clue what we're facing."
"The newbies aren't ready," Milo stated flatly. "Most of them would get killed if it gets hairy."
"Who do we have who's ready, then?" Harbinger asked. "We can keep them in reserve. They don't need to be in front."
"Meade, Lee, and maybe Triple J,"
Grant said. Green could, except that oaf put him in the hospital.
Newcastle can handle support, Milo added.
Agreed, stated Harbinger.
What about Pitt?
Julie asked.
No way. He's out of control, Grant replied hotly.
He's also the best shooter we have. I hate to admit it, but he's even better than I am, Sam said.
The big cowboy banged the table for emphasis.
Pitt's a hothead. He'll blow it, Grant retorted.
He is a natural leader, however. Milo stuck up for me.
Put him in charge of the newbie squad. The others will follow him.
I vote that he goes, Julie said. You heard the French. They lost a whole team on that boat. We don't know what's out there. We need every shooter we can get.
I don't like the Frenchies, but their hunters are first rate. I'll give them that, Milo said.
If something on that ship took out their team, then I'm guessing that it's bad news.
I've got a feeling we're going to need trigger pullers.
Done. Wake up Pitt, Jones, Meade, Lee, and Newcastle. Let's move, folks. Clock's ticking,
Harbinger ordered. Grant sulked, and the rest of the team sprang into action.
Cool, I thought to my disembodied self. This was an interesting dream.
Harbinger jumped as if somebody had startled him. He turned and scowled at the corner of the room that held my consciousness. Before he could act, my presence was suddenly jerked out of the room, through the roof, and into the night sky, leaving the man scowling in puzzlement at the now empty room. I heard the mysterious old man's voice.
Sorry. Lost you for a minute. I have not done this before.
The ground flashed by below as my awareness sped through the air at what had to be 1,000 miles an hour. The darkness was interrupted by the occasional lights of human activity, and finally a mass of lights on an otherwise dark coast came into focus as we appeared to slow. I could sense masses of people, most sleeping, a smaller number awake. The ocean stretched black and unrelenting before us, while above, unfettered by normal human senses, I could make out literally billions of stars. It was beautiful. Then I was on a dark beach. Behind me was a patch of swampy forest, lit by incandescent gases and teeming with life. Out to sea, something approached. I could sense the shape of men in a small lifeboat. The boat moved soundlessly toward the beach, propelled not by wind, oar, or engine, but rather by some force that even in my dream state I could not understand. As the boat approached, the sounds of life behind us were suddenly silent, as every living creature either fled or hid. Somehow I knew that even the fish in the water were swimming away from the boat in a panic. They knew something in their simple brains that all of the sleeping humans nearby did not. An unnatural fog, somehow icy in the humid southern air, swirled around the small craft.
"He comes," said the old man.
"Who is he?" my dream self asked.
"I know him as the Cursed One."
There were multiple shapes in the boat. Some appeared to be human and were crouched low in the hull, red eyes scanning the beach, noses sniffing the air for prey. I recognized them from Harbinger's lectures. Vampires. The kings and queens of the undead. And from the vibe that I was getting from them, these were ancient and powerful beings. Master vampires. According to my lessons, masters were solitary creatures who had never been known to work together. Apparently the lessons had been very wrong. My dream was getting ugly. Standing in the midst of the creatures was some thing. At first it appeared to be a man, cloaked in a huge robe, Only the reflection of what appeared to be a polished steel breastplate and helmet could be made out through the unnatural fog. The armor reminded me of the type that the conquistadors had worn. A sense of pure evil emanated from the cloaked being, an icy feeling of dread that I could feel piercing through my consciousness. I could not imagine how horrible it would have been if I had been there in my physical body instead of in this dream. As the image drew closer, I could see a mass of withering blackness glistening between the creases of the armor and under the helmet. I could not comprehend what it was, but it certainly was not flesh. Somehow the twitching movement brought back memories of the boxes of live earthworms that my father used to fish with. It looked almost like the famous painting of Washington crossing the Delaware, only this time featuring a host of evil undead and some hideous monstrosity in the place of a great general. There was a name painted on the side of the craft. Antoine Henri. The lifeboat glided up to the sand with a crunch, and the vampires immediately sprang out and formed a protective circle around the thing. Some splashed out into the surf to cover that direction. There were six of them, both male and female, and they were unnaturally graceful and swift. They were evil and savage, but somehow beautiful at the same time. A seventh vampire remained in the craft with its master. If the thing was the commander, then that vampire was its lieutenant. I felt a seething hatred around me. It was coming from the old man, and it was directed at that seventh and final vampire in particular. It was a tall, pale thing with a hatchet face, slicked back hair, and a dark trench coat that it wore like a uniform. The vampire actually stood at attention as the armored monstrosity glided onto the beach. When the thing touched the sand, the whole universe jolted. A blast of discomfort rippled through every living being for hundreds of miles. You may have felt it yourself. An unexplained shiver, a sensation of fear that had come out of nowhere, a crawling feeling in the pit of your gut, a jolt that tore you out of sleep. That was the cursed one setting foot on his new land. The lead vampire announced something in a foreign language. It took me a moment to recognize it as Portuguese, or a dialect thereof. I knew enough of the language to understand. "Welcome home, Lord Machado," the creature crowed, bowing deeply. All of the other vampires forming the perimeter immediately bowed as well, the ones in the surf submerging themselves completely in the saltwater waves. It did not matter to them. They did not need air. The abnormal fog drifted up onto the beach, serving as the fanfare for the abomination before us. "Your kingdom awaits." The thing was silent. It slowly rotated, taking in the sight. Beneath the cloak and armor, I could not tell how it moved, but it was black and damp and slithery. It turned until it looked right at us. I could feel its gaze sweep across us, and if I had been in my body, I would have been trembling. I could not see eyes, but somehow it knew we were there. Instantly, the vampires jerked up and followed their leader's gaze, somehow locking on to the old man and me. I felt fear greater than I ever had before, greater than when I had died, greater than anything I could imagine. The creature did not want my life. It wanted my very soul, and the soul of every person I had ever loved. "Hello, Barika," the lead vampire smiled, revealing pointed incisors. "My, it certainly has been a while, hasn't it? I see you brought a friend." The cursed one raised a strangely jointed, cloaked limb and pointed at us. I could feel the flash of panic from my incorporeal companion. With a flash of sand and seawater, several massive shapes crashed into the surf around us. I had not sensed them circling above. Giant, horrific things, with massive wings beating, they surrounded us and moved toward us.